Greetings, Tacoma. John Doherty here once again for KTAH 101.9's Climate Talk, the place where we talk about everything climate and always respectfully. You know, the sad truth is that as a species, we're falling behind on taking mitigation steps regarding carbon dioxide emissions that are affecting the temperature of the Earth and from there just about everything else in our atmospheric and oceanic environments. The ideal would be that we are going to limit our CO2 emissions and we're going to avoid the worst aspects of a possible overheating of the Earth, but right now a realist would say we're going to fall short in that regard. So does that mean nothing else can be done? Well, no, not exactly. There are theoretical steps that we can take to decrease the warming, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Brief background, particles in the air affect how much the sun's rays warm the Earth. So we have some examples. After 9/11, we had a few days with no airplanes up in the atmosphere, and the lack of contrails created a measurable change in the weather. Ships at sea emit tiny particles with their exhausts, and those particles have an effect on creating clouds out over the ocean. Smoke from wildfires changed the local weather. So what steps could we take to reduce the amount of the warming? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about today, a subject called marine cloud brightening. We're talking to Sarah Doherty and Robert Wood. They're scientists up at the University of Washington that are a part of the Marine Cloud Brightening Project. Okay, so what's marine cloud brightening? Well, let's find out.
We're happy to have Sarah Doherty and Robert Wood with us today. They are both scientists up at the University of Washington. Sarah Doherty, no relation, by the way, is a research scientist there, a senior research scientist in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, and she has responsibilities for the Marine Cloud Brightening Project, which is going to be our topic today. Also have Professor Robert Wood. He's also in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, and he's the lead scientist on the Marine Cloud Brightening Project. So, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So let's just start off with the basics. What is marine cloud brightening?
So perhaps I could answer that one. So clouds, as we know, when you look at satellite pictures from space, you see clouds, basically. The blue marble of Earth has a lot of clouds on it. Why you're seeing those is that you're seeing sunlight reflected back into space from the Earth system. And what that's doing is that sunlight is going back into space. It's not therefore entering the climate system. And so clouds, what they're doing all the time is cooling the Earth. They're providing a cooling system for the Earth by reflecting sunlight that would otherwise reach the Earth's surface. Every cloud droplet, most clouds on the Earth are liquid cloud, which means they consist of very, very small droplets, about the same size as a human hair, somewhat smaller, about that size, though. Many, many droplets. Each of those droplets, it turns out, forms on a very, very small particle called an aerosol particle. People may be familiar with these. Smoke particles are one example of that. And we've seen a lot of smoke in Seattle recently and over the summer. Sea salt is another type of particle, and there's also a significant amount of anthropogenic pollution, human-produced pollution that produces these particles. Each droplet forms on one of these particles, and it turns out that if you put more particles into a cloud, those clouds, droplets become smaller. The liquid in those clouds is distributed over a larger number of particles, and the overall surface area of those droplets is increased. And that means you essentially increase the amount of sunlight being reflected back to space from those. So the idea behind marine cloud brightening is that if you potentially increase the number of particles, aerosol particles going into clouds, you could potentially make them more reflective of sunlight, ever so small amount more reflective, and reflect a little bit more sunlight back into space and potentially serve as a cooling, additional cooling effect on the planet.
So if I could, just a clarification. So you're talking about the surface area. So are you talking about actually the amount of the ocean that would be covered with a particular cloud system, or do the clouds just become maybe more dense and therefore more reflective?
Yeah, so the idea behind marine cloud branding is not that you're creating any more clouds. There are already, over the oceans, the oceans are covered by around 80% of cloud already. The idea is that you take existing clouds and you just make them a little bit more reflective of sunlight by adding more particles into them. And the way marine cloud branding could work is that you would use existing salt particles from the ocean water, seawater, which is already a significant source of those particles, but you would just increase that number of particles going into the cloud and you would make them a little bit brighter.
So you've already alluded to this, but making clear here that really the goal is to have some impact on the degree of warming of the atmosphere. Is that right?
Yeah. So as we know, climate change is caused primarily by carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, which serve to warm the climate system. And what we would try to do with marine cloud brightening, the idea would be to actually not change the long wave radiation, the thermal radiation that is affected by the greenhouse gases, but we would try to reflect a little bit more sunlight back to space, which would then serve as a cooling effect to try and compensate for some of this warming and therefore avert as much warming as we're expecting to get.
Okay, understood. And I'm just curious, so does this process result in more precipitation, or it's just neutral or not a factor? What's the deal?
It's a very good question, and that's one of the things we want to address as we go forward with this research. There are different phases of this research, different types of research we can do, and one of them is to see if we do brighten clouds in over the ocean, what does happen to the precipitation patterns, the patterns of rainfall over the land, for example, where it's most important for humanity. And that is a significant question, and it's something that we can address with climate models. Currently, there haven't been enough climate model simulations done, really, to look at the effects of marine cloud brightening and what it potentially might do to rainfall over the Earth. So there's a real gap there in the research that I think needs to be done if we're going to consider marine cloud brightening as a potential source of climate way to offset global warming.
Yeah, so I can imagine, just politically speaking, that if it did start changing precipitation patterns, that there could be consternation coming from some quarters with a result like that.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. So I guess I want to backtrack a little bit and just point out that while this is a concept that could cool climate, this is not a solution to climate change or global warming. The idea really is to try and alleviate some of the heat stress from global warming, and just as a way of avoiding some of the potentially most severe impacts of climate change while working to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So it's really important. We just can't stress strongly enough that the most important thing that needs to happen is, of course, reduction of greenhouse gases. But because that's not, as we've seen, this is not happening right now at a fast enough rate to avert significant climate change. The idea with marine cloud brightening and other potential ideas like it is that it would be sort of a holdover to get us through the worst part of a climate crisis, basically, while the climate system is catching up to a reduction in greenhouse gases that would allow us to return to a safer climate system. So when you talk about, you know, it is possible that if you did marine cloud brightening, that you would end up affecting precipitation and maybe other things in a way that's not ideal. But what we really need to do is look at this in a sort of a risk-risk framework. What are the risks of going forward as we are? Letting climate continue to warm, hopefully, ideally, I believe eventually reducing greenhouse gas emissions sufficiently that we have a safer climate. But weighing that against implementing some of these things like marine cloud brightening possibly, and understanding what would be the benefits and risks of doing marine cloud brightening along with having climate warming versus not doing marine cloud brightening with having climate warming, and understanding how those balance out.
Yeah, I believe I understand your point exactly. Of course, I'm a climate activist, and in a lot of the circles that I have discussions with, there's concerns about geoengineering kinds of projects, that those will become an excuse for not limiting greenhouse gases. So I appreciate your point that this is really not an answer. It's just a means of stepping in on a shorter timeline as we wait for the various political entities to start taking greenhouse gas emissions seriously. I mean, is that a fair summary?
Absolutely. And this is something that's really discussed in the arena of geoengineering or climate intervention, as we like to call it. And it's the moral hazard that if you have this as a potential sort of fix, which I put in quotes, that you would be less incentivized to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But there's actually been some indication that things could go the other way. If you try and think of it from the perspective of someone who's not taking climate change very seriously right now, and those are really the people we need to convince that we need to do something about greenhouse gas emissions. From their perspective, some of those people, if they see that people like us who are scientists, people who are, maybe on the more the left side of the political spectrum are actually considering things like this, which are, controversial potentially and difficult. It's a difficult problem to sort of take on. What would the impacts of this be? Basically, by looking at this as a possible thing that we might do, that they actually look at you and say, wow, you're actually taking this seriously. This actually is really a problem. The fact that you're considering, doing things like this makes me take this problem more seriously. And there's been some indication it can actually cut that direction. And in fact, it has helped build, the fact that we're considering these things has helped build some support for investigation into climate science across the political spectrum.
Yeah, sure. And I want to make clear that me asking that question was more in the way of background. It's real clear that when it comes to climate change, it's clear to me at least that there are no perfect solutions. I mean, I think you use the risk comparison, risk reward comparison, or some language to that extent, which absolutely I see is true. So there's nothing under the sun that somebody can't find some criticism for it. So
right.
So understood on that. So let's get back to the science part for a second. I'm interested in knowing, so what actual science are you carrying out? What experiments, what studies are actually being carried out? How do you do that?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. I think that's a big part of the research into marine cloud brightening is exactly how much brightening of the clouds, how much extra sunlight could these clouds reflect if we were to add particles? So that's one question. And that's, we're doing a lot of work right now with numerical models, with computer models, with very high resolution what we call cloud resolving models that can actually simulate the processes by which aerosols are transported into clouds and clouds are reflecting sunlight. And the reason why we're doing a lot of that work actually already is because we know aerosol particles from inadvertent human activities over the industrial period have produced a lot more particles by some measures, estimates. There's something like a third to two-thirds of all the particles in the atmosphere are actually produced by humans, or indirectly or directly produced by humans, which is a huge perturbation, huge change to the system. And those clouds are already being brightened to some extent, reflecting more sunlight these days. And this is the IPCC look at this. I've assessed this for a couple of decades. And so there's quite a lot of research going on already. What we really want to do is be able to do, and the reason why we don't fully understand this highly uncertain aerosol effect on climate right now is because clouds are complicated, frankly. The processes by which they interact with particles are very poorly understood. Climate models are very coarse resolution, so you can't really resolve all these turbulent processes that are going on in clouds very well in climate models. And so what we're trying to do is improve our climate models. And actually, one of the ways we think we might be able to do that is by doing small-scale outdoor experiments to actually create little perturbed clouds and go out there with aircraft and instrumentation to measure those clouds and to see how big are the perturbations are to the not just the amount of sunlight reflected, but all the what we call the small scale microphysical processes, the droplet distributions in the clouds. So we're trying to right now work with a group in California in the Palo Alto Research Center who are designing and building a spray system to go out and perturb a very small region of the atmosphere and be able to increase the number of particles in that region and perturb a cloud. And we would hopefully go out and measure it. And by doing this, we would actually be able to test these models. It would be a more like a control experiment. In the atmosphere, we don't usually get to go out and do these control experiments where we can turn on and off the sprayer and contrast the effects. We have to just wait and see what comes. And so this is a sort of a new type of experiment, I think, to be able to do this control experiment. So that's one of the areas in which we're working on quite avidly right now.
So are you going out on ships going out on the ocean?
Right now, we're still in the lab phase of this work, where we've built over the last, frankly, a decade of research, been able to build a single spray system nozzle, what we call a nozzle, that we would have to upscale to maybe a thousandfold to be able to build something that would actually go out and make a perturbation that we could measure in the real atmosphere. So we're still at the phase of being able to do that work and build a spray system that we can actually go and do outdoor experiments. But we're hoping that within the next year or so, we will start moving that into outdoor experiments, maybe in a hangar system to test the distribution of particles, and then eventually go out on a boat, probably over the cloudy region off the coast of the western United States, to try and do some outdoor experiments to test this system.
So looking at the beginning, middle, and end of the project, where would you put us?
That's a very good question, because it really depends on how successful this is. There is a chance that we will find that it turns out to be either technologically or scientifically, for one reason or another, much less promising a technique than we may have thought right now. In which case, the experiments may end early. But if they're successful, on the other hand, and perhaps I'll leave Sarah to also address this question. But if they're successful, then we would consider doing what we're planning to do to start with is perturb one little region of cloud, and then we would go to presumably do larger scale experiments if the technology proved to be successful. So we would need to because if you think about going from a single experiment to actually a deployment, which is a huge difference. There's a lot of work that needs to be done in the between those, but it wouldn't be just, we would hope there would be a much larger community of people working on that problem by then. But maybe Sarah could also think about that question.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we're quite near the beginning. The work that we're doing, the program at University of Washington, is really about investigating the science of whether this could work, whether you could intentionally, in a controlled way, brighten clouds, and what would be the impact of doing that if you were to do it at a global scale. But our work would really stop at the sort of proof of the reaching a level of understanding as to whether or not this would be feasible. And there's a big jump, like Rob said, between going from the scale of things we would do, which would be experiments, in the real environment at a really, in all cases, at quite a small scale, and actually implementing marine cloud brightening, which would be done there'd be a whole another set of challenges involved with going from understanding how you could do this to actually doing that. And like Rob said, there's a lot of work to be done between, even if we did could show that this was doable, between showing that it was doable and actually how you would implement it, both from a engineering standpoint to, you know, even more so an ethical standpoint, a governance standpoint, how you would deal with this. You can imagine the international politics involved with any attempt to go out and intentionally cool climate.
Yeah, I get it. So just in layperson terms, I believe what I'm hearing you saying is something like you're doing research as to whether there's enough feasibility that further research would be called for.
Yeah, yes. There's to understand whether this approach could be feasible, and it would be up to a very large body of other people to decide whether or not this ever should be done, how it would be done, both from a logistical standpoint and a political standpoint.
Understood. So I am curious, once again, just as a layperson, how would the shooting of the salt water, the particles into the atmosphere, I mean, how far up is it going to go? What kind of device would do that? What's going on there?
So I could take a stab at that. The idea here is really to just constrain this to the lower part of the atmosphere. And this is why we're targeting particular types of clouds in the marine layer over the ocean, which is actually a layer that's capped by a temperature inversion. And so particles get trapped into that layer. And that helps us actually because it means that they don't get distributed very far up into the atmosphere. This marine layer's typically 1,000 meters or 3,000 feet thick. We would actually want to take the spray system out over the ocean, which is going to generate particles that are about 100 nanometers in size. The size of a cloud droplet, on the other hand, is more like 10 micrometers, so much, much larger. But these little tiny particles of salt that we would generate, either from seawater or sodium chloride, we wouldn't have to spray all that much mass or that much weight of material because we're making these particles very small, but nevertheless, they're large enough to be able to influence the population of clouds. Now, one of the things we're finding is that when we spray these particles, we actually have to lose quite a bit of the water from the seawater, and we have to evaporate that with the technique we're working on now. So that could generate some cooling. So we may have to provide some additional source of heat to be able to lift that particle, those particles up towards the cloud, which sits typically at the top of the marine layer, maybe 2,000 feet up in the atmosphere. And so we're currently working on what we would have to do from an engineering perspective to actually make that work. An example here is that this a process similar to this happens all the time when marine container ships over the ocean, which burn fossil fuels, diesel fuel, and they produce particles and they get lofted up into clouds all the time. And we can see those evidence of those as tracks in the cloud. That's not salt particles, but that's particles of sulfurous material from fuel. But because the stacks are quite warm, that material lofts up naturally into the atmosphere. And once you've lifted the particles about 100 meters above the surface, then the natural circulations in the boundary layer, as we call it, in the marine layer, actually transport the particles up into the cloud, where they can then serve as nuclei on which the cloud droplets form.
Understood. So just out of curiosity, I'm looking out my window right now. I'm down in Tacoma, Washington, and there's this low-lying stratus that's coming in from the southwest. Is this the kind of clouds you're talking about?
Yep. These are exactly the same. I think we've got the same clouds here as well in Seattle, but as we so commonly have in the winter, especially in the winter. These are the types of clouds that you would perturb. We wouldn't be aiming to do it over the land because we want to restrict this to the ocean. The ocean has a far greater a number of these types of clouds than the land does. So we would restrict our spraying to be offshore where you know, the additional salt isn't going to come onto the land. But it is this type of cloud, very much so, yeah.
So one of the things, once again, as a layperson, that I believe I've noticed is that small, relatively small changes to cloud cover can have a pretty significant impact. I'm thinking of, of course, you mentioned the ships at sea. I noticed that the fires in Australia in the southern last southern summer, the smoke that blew out over the ocean had a measurable impact on temperatures. So it does seem like it is kind of a leverage point, maybe, in terms of managing temperature.
I mean, certainly, you know, with the smoke itself, actually, without even influencing clouds, can have a cooling effect by on the surface by reflecting sunlight, the particles themselves, let alone when they get into clouds and make the clouds themselves brighter. So, yeah, we've known for a long time that aerosol particles are one of the, you know, key controls, climatologically speaking, over the temperature of the planet. The Mount Pinatubo eruption, volcanic eruption in 1991, also cooled Earth by, you know, upwards of half a degree Celsius or a degree Fahrenheit for several years. And that was caused by particles interacting with sunlight and cooling, reflecting more sunlight. So we've known for quite a long time that this is an effect that happens in the natural environment. And so what we're trying to do here is use that impact, that effect, and sort of increase its strength, I guess.
Understood. So let's talk about the political policy stuff just a little bit here. It is kind of strange, I think, that we've reached this point in our social system that science is having to deal with politics so much. Although I guess that's been true one way or the other over the centuries as well. So, Sarah, I'm just wondering if what has your experience been with the federal government over the last few years in terms of support or detracting from this kind of scientific work?
Yeah, there hasn't been a lot of federal funding support for research in this area until the last few years. There's been some support for doing modeling, computational modeling, but there's a growing support for doing research in this area, in part because by doing this research, as Rob alluded to earlier, we're going to simply learn more about how the climate system works, how we're already changing climate by adding pollution particles to clouds inadvertently. But also, I think there's just a recognition that we're not slowing greenhouse gas emissions quickly enough to avert significant climate change. So I think the federal government perspective is coming around to recognizing that we have a real threat ahead. You know, and that these approaches are something that understanding whether or not they might work and what the implications would be of doing them is something that research is going to take, you know, a decade or more. And then figuring out how you would actually implement them if you wanted to would take another chunk of time. And so I think the thinking is coming around to the recognizing that they may be facing that decision in 20 years, having to face the decision in 20 years of experiencing significant climate disruption. And even with, you know, significant greenhouse gas reductions, the climate will continue to warm for a period of decades. So I think the federal government is starting to understand the need to do research into these in these areas so that they are in a position to make a decision 10 or 20 years from now about what their options are.
Okay, interesting, and kind of contrary to what I might have expected, because with a lot of the climate denial that's been coming from the federal government, not only from the administration, but from Congress as well, it's interesting that aspects, at least, of the federal government are starting to take this seriously. Do you expect to see any changes as the administration changes this coming January?
Well, I expect in general. So, you know, I'm a scientist. I'm not a political scientist. So I'm speaking based on talking to colleagues. But, you know, certainly I would expect the new administration to be taking the climate problem in general more seriously than the previous administration did, and hopefully allocating some resources accordingly. But again, that's kind of out of my area of expertise.
Yeah, well, I understand. And so we are getting close to the end here. So let's just finish up talking about that a little bit here. You're not the first scientist that's indicated some, let's call it discomfort, for lack of a better term, talking about politics and so on. I mean, I think typically scientists feel like it's their job to go out and find out what's going on in the real world and to give an honest assessment of that, and then let other folks, like the political scientists, for instance, as you referred to, decide what to do with it. Science, I think it's fair to say a lot of science has been under attack recently. And once again, of course, historically, that's been true at various times too, but I think this is a particularly onerous period in terms of public attacks on science. So what do you think that scientists as a group, and I'm asking for a generalization here, I guess, scientists as a group are going to be more engaged in the public discourse about what steps we should take, in particular about climate change?
I guess I would put it a little bit differently than how you just said. I think that scientists increasingly have recognized the importance of communicating science to the public to provide an information basis on which people can decide what should be done about climate change. You know, and keeping in mind that what should be done about climate change involves the science, understanding of the science of how the climate is changing and what the impacts of that are likely to be, but then also involves information about what would be the costs, what are the options for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, for technological fixes, for adaptation, and what are the socioeconomic costs of implementing those things, and how does that play out in our economy, and how does that play out ethically? And that, of course, moves into areas scientists aren't involved with. So I would say that scientists are increasingly motivated to make sure the public understands the risks of climate change and how they will really, truly, and tangibly impact economies and human lives and health and safety, but not necessarily what solutions we should adopt, other than it's very clear from the science that the only way we're going to solve climate change is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah. So I'm taking away that your point that if there is a change in emphasis, that change is more towards communicating in a way that's accessible to the public what's going on. And I do think that's a critically important area, because I go in and look at some of the technical journals, and I'd call myself a reasonably sophisticated amateur, and I have a very difficult time with a lot of them making heads or tails out of what these scientists are talking about because of the technicalities and the jargon and so on. And then what we do get is filtered through the science journalists, generally speaking, and even worse than that, just the political pundits. So I take your point, how important it is that scientists get on top of the communication process so that we can make good decisions.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think the federal agencies who sponsor a lot of our research are actually moving very much in that direction, from insisting that we put together public statements of our research that are more accessible, and communicating, emphasizing the broader impacts of the work beyond just the knowledge gained. So I think we are moving towards a world in which there is a greater communication from the scientific community to the general public, and also would welcome greater engagement with the public, of course.
Well, let's just say that this conversation today is a little part of exactly what we're talking about at the moment here. So we are getting to the end. Are there any other topics that we should be talking about or that you'd like to introduce before we sign off?
No, I think I'd mostly like to say thanks to you for doing your part in trying to help the public better understand the issues around climate change and the science of climate change.
Yeah, me too. I appreciate the work from the Citizens Climate Lobby, and I like that.
All right, great. Well, once again, thanks so much for taking the time out of your lives, which I know are busy and helping us to understand what's going on. And we're, as Washingtonians, we're proud of the work that the University of Washington is doing to move towards a better future.
Well, thank you and have a good holiday.
Okay. And thank you too, Rob. Okay. Good day.
Okay, let's wrap up here. Dr. Doherty made the very clear point that this kind of effort can never be a replacement for drastically reducing our worldwide CO2 output, and the problems of getting from here to there are many. Working to reflect sun energy back into space is a bit like putting a blue tarp over a leaking roof. Stopgap, but not the solution. I'm grateful that our institutions and our best minds, as embodied in Drs. Doherty and Wood, are investing time, energy, money into creating reality-based possibilities for the future, and especially for our hometown climate heroes at the UW. You can check out some links for work that's being done in the Marine Cloud Brightening Project at ccltacoma.org. That's the homepage for the local Citizens Climate Lobby chapter. Good stuff in there. Check it out. Also, I'm interested in hearing what you think. You can contact me at John, J-O-H-N, at ccltacoma.org. That's it for now. Here's me reminding you, as always, live like the mountain's out. Take care.